hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Welcome back to A Hamster with a Blunt Penknife, the Doctor Who commentary podcast. I am Jason Thompson, and I am not only here with the amazing Joe Ford, I'm actually here with the amazing Joe Ford.
He's come all the way to Eastbourne today. We've just been down the pier for a bit of lunch.
Very nice it was too.
We've got a gloriously sunny day, and we're choosing to spend it in a dark room watching six episodes of The Sea Devils.
Well, what else do you do on a gloriously sunny day, Joe? Really? Well,
you and me talking about Doctor Who, that's very unusual. Because I will say one thing to you, because we're sort of snuggled up here on the sofa about to watch this together, is I do normally sit and watch TV in my underpants, but today I've put on jeans for you. I hope you appreciate the effort.
I wish you'd told me that before I stripped down to my underwear.
Put it away, honestly.
Just to reassure any listeners of a nervous disposition, we are both fully clothed. It's all good.
I'm not confirming or denying that statement.
But we are doing something rather unusual for us, for our podcast, in that all the episodes of the story we're about to watch actually exist, which it's been a while.
It was a Saranga conundrum. I'm going to try and get this right in order. We started with Mysterious Planet.
We did.
Fabulous. I never thought I'd find anyone that would champion that one.
Ah, I love it.
We had a lovely chat about that. In fact, didn't I hear you whoring yourself off on Dave Rennie's talking about that as well?
Yes, indeed. So if anyone else wants to do a podcast about the Mysterious Planet, I am available.
I believe Jason Miller might be doing the Target book soon.
I've not long read that, so that'd be great.
Oh, there we go. Perfect. Then we did Saranga Conundrum.
Yep.
Another one I figured I'd struggle to find somebody to talk to about. Then we did Power of the Daleks.
We did.
Then we did The Daleks Master Plan, yep, in three separate recordings, because God help us, nobody can talk for...
Nobody's going to sit through 13 episodes solid talking. We'd have been completely insane by the end of it.
What is the runtime of The Daleks Master Plan?
Dalek Master Plan must be something like 4 hours or so. Five hours.
Talk to me for 5 hours solid. Oh, wait, we've done that today, haven't we?
it's longer than that, because we always talk a lot longer around the episodes.
It's true. In fact, the runtime of that story plus Mission to the Unknown is still the longest ever hamster. I think Flux comes close. Because there was a lot of extra conversation on there, and I haven't done the War Games yet, so we'll see. Then we did
Evil of the Daleks.
That's the last one we did, isn't it?
That was the last one we did, yes.
Yeah. And now we're back in glorious Technicolor.
In glorious Technicolor, with something that has something in common with the last one we did, actually.
Go on.
In that, as with The Evil of the Daleks, we both watched this one recently at the BFI.
We did, and it was glorious, wasn't it?
It was wonderful. It was great.
There is something about, now I've said to you before, I don't really like big crowds. So I've sort of shied away from the last couple of BFIs because sometimes it is a bit overwhelming. I know, people look at me strange when I say that because they figure I'm the most sociable person going. But I like this. I like one-on-one.
There's a world of difference between being sociable with one or two people at a time, especially over the podcast if you're separated by geography and you're in your own room, versus being surrounded by people.
Yeah.
For most of it, you're sat in a darkened room and it doesn't really matter that there are 400 people sitting around you because you can ignore them, but then you have to do the bar and the...
But that's the bit I like. So watching the programme and sharing the experience, so I love that bit of it. And people laughing at stuff that I've never considered funny before, then realising just, like Revelation of the Daleks, I never knew how funny that was until I watched it with that crowd.
Well, I'll tell you what you missed on the Five Doctors.
Oh, no.
Was everybody joining in with, what? No, not the mind probe, which was hilarious. It was absolutely brilliant.
But what, even Peter Davison?
He may have done, I don't know.
I bet he did. He can be a bit cheeky sometimes. it was a fabulous watch through. And I think they sensibly cut it into three lots of two episodes.
Yes.
With interviews in between.
They did, yeah.
So we're doing a bit of marketing for the BFI now, but go to those events because it is the full package.
Yeah, they are difficult to get hold of, the tickets, sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, the Five Doctors sold out in 3 minutes, but, you know, it was a big thing. That was going to go quick. But if you can get to the BFI, if you can get a ticket, or you know someone who can get you a ticket absolutely recommend it. It's one of my favourite Doctor Who events that I've ever done. I've now been to so many of them. I'm going to miss the next one, actually, because I have a prior engagement.
The Underwater Menace. Honestly, an absolute classic. How could you?
So I shan't be there for that one, unfortunately. But yeah, definitely recommend the BFI.
I hope it's a wedding or a funeral or something like that that you're going to miss a trip to Atlantis for. Oh, you're remaining tight-lipped. All right.
That's because I don't want a lynch mob going after the people I'm going to see.
Fair enough. The Sea Devils. Now, obviously, we're going to talk throughout the episodes, but I do want to ask you one question before we go in.
Oh, you surprised me, Joe.
Here your inquisition begins. And that is, it's not a unit story, and yet, is this still the quintessential Pertwee story?
I think it really is, because it's not unit, but it's still a military organisation being involved with aliens. And yeah, I think it's very much quintessential Third Doctor era, I think.
You practically bit my hand off to do this one on Hamster. So I want an explanation as to why. Because there's quite a few Pertwees I haven't done yet. I haven't done Inferno yet, you know. And yet you specifically asked for the Sea Devils. So why this one?
The Sea Devils is a personal favourite. I know it comes in for a lot of flack because it's basically just the Silurians redone with the Master chucked in and is less interesting, doesn't cover the same moral dilemmas as the Silurians, etc., etc. And it's basically Malcolm Hulk just rehashing a story that he's already done, which is fair, but it is also brilliantly done. I think it's a really nicely polished production, generally speaking, with one possible exception, which we'll come to in episode 6, which is just ludicrous.
I know there'd be something in here you'd find ludicrous.
Oh, there's plenty of ludicrous stuff in it. It's Doctor Who. The whole premise is ludicrous, let's be honest.
That is true.
But well, the Sea Devils...
You're on safer ground usually on these Earthbound stories, aren't you? Usually.
Usually. But the Sea Devils in particular, because I was still riding high on the BFI experience of doing it, which was just fabulous. And B, I mean, my first Pertwee story.
Oh, the repeats
and
on
the repeats
BBC
in
two.
1992 yeah. On BBC Two. So yeah, my very first John Pertwee story, and it has a connection to my childhood as well, because it's not supposed to be set there, but it's filmed in Portsmouth, and my family, my grandparents, are all from around Hampshire.
Okay.
So when I was a kid, we used to go to Portsmouth quite regularly. We used to go to the harbour and see the Ark Royal and the other naval ships and what have you, and that sea fort.
It's a hotel now, isn't it?
I think it is.
A friend of mine stayed. I think it's got a golf course on top of it.
Yeah, I can believe it. But that Sea Fort is something I'd seen many times. So when I saw it pop up on the telly, because I didn't know anything about the Sea Devils when I first saw it, I thought, oh, hang on. So it kind of has a connection to my family as well, as tenuous as it is. So that's why I kind of really, really enjoy watching the Sea Devils.
I am going to take a punt and say, I think this might be one of the most robust productions of any Doctor Who story. The location work, the hardware on display, the Navy, so the numbers of people there, the action sequences, even the stock footage, which really does suit the action.
Yes.
Half the time, I don't know what's being shot and what's stock footage.
Yeah.
I mean, usually when it's sort of bombs going up in the air, things like that, I figure that they've taken that from the library. But it's one of those stories where I just don't think there's too much to be embarrassed by. I remember, well, and I say that with the knowledge that when I first watched this on BBC Two, I told you earlier, my uncle, who was babysitting me, age 12, I was a very young 12, derided the Sea Devils, calling them the monsters where the eyes don't move. And he's been saying that whenever I bring up Doctor Who, he's like, is it the monsters where the eyes don't? I showed him the CGI Sea Devils are the reason why. I went, look, the eyes are moving. And he went, well, they ain't moving much, are they? I was like, oh, for God's sakes.
So no pleasing sound.
You either get it or you don't, right? But I think in terms of money on the screen, this is one of the best Doctor Who stories.
Yeah, I think it is a really solid production. Say, as you say, the location work and the studio work and the stock footage all work together nicely. Sometimes the stock footage in a Doctor Who story doesn't work, like... Voris's Sky Striker, the model, which then cuts to a very recognisable...
Hasn't it got the name of the rocket on it?
A very recognisable Saturn V launch with the words United States going up the side of the screen. Yeah.
There was a United States, I believe, on Voga, the planet of gold.
There may well have been. But yeah, so sometimes the stock footage is just a little bit too jarring, but in this one it really, really works. It really gels nicely.
Well, look, we've got six episodes to get through. Shall I press play on episode one?
We better get started with episode one, haven't we?
Look, we talked 10 minutes already. Look, we haven't even started yet.
Get started. Right. Let's go.
Cat is in them.
These good people want to hear us talking about Doctor Who.
In?
Okay. In 3, 2, 1.
Off we go. I may have to change the... We've got a little bit of volume there. That's nice.
That's good.
Okay. That's very Dayglow, that title sequence, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah. Oh, nicely remastered on Blu-ray.
God, look how gorgeous he looks in HD. Oh, John Pertwee. I've got much to say about John Pertwee in this story, because I do believe we might see him at his best and his worst.
Quite possibly. Quite possibly, yeah.
Doctor Who loves a cold open, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
This reminds me a bit of... Terror of the Zygons as well, you know, that sort
very similar sort of thing, isn't it? Yeah, sudden distress call. And I like the little touches, like Captain Hart walking in, fastening up his jacket, because he's clearly
just been pulled in
for this emergency. And his hair's a bit untidy.
Can we talk about Hart straight away then? Because I think I'm going to be a bit controversial and say I think Edwin Richfield gives a more interesting performance as Hart than Nicholas Courtney does as the Brigadier. Now, he's a reliable figure, the Brigadier, but we kind of know what to expect from him for the most part. I feel like he's a bit edgy, Captain Hart. He's a bit spiky.
He is, yeah. I do like Captain Hart. And I think it's quite nicely placed, actually, in the narrative, because by this point, the Doctor's been exiled to Earth for 2 and a bit years already. He's settled in as the unit scientific advisor. You know what you're going to get from the Brigadier. He doesn't have to convince anyone of his intentions or anything like that. And now you get
back at square one, aren't we?
Back at square one. He's come up to a new military base and he's got to persuade this guy that he knows what he's talking about and that he should be taken seriously. John Pertwee is clearly in his element on the sea.
Oh, of course he is, yeah. I mean, I love the sea as well, you know. That's why I'm here in Eastbourne. I've got to say, because I've always found the location work in the Sea Devils a bit distracting, because on the VHS, it was very grainy and a bit sort of ugly looking. The colours were all wrong. They've really polished it up. It looks bloody gorgeous on this Blu-ray.
It does. It does indeed.
Oh, my. Here's, what's his name? Trenchard. Yes.
General Trenchard. Yeah.
Another interesting character.
Yeah, very much so. And these little Citroen 2CVs with their doors missing. That's
Michael, have you heard the commentary of this story?
No, I haven't.
So, okay, this is where a lot of my trivia is going to come from.
Because
you've got Barry Letts, Terrence Dix, Michael E. Bryan, and it's been moderated by Andrew Cartmell.
Oh.
The only time he did it, and I can see why. Because he's not only moderating, he's giving his opinion throughout.
Oh, God.
Yeah, no.
Oh, here's...
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but is the Doctor a little patronising with Trenchard?
Oh, completely. Completely and totally, yes. He's an authority figure who's just... I mean, he started off by... demonstrating himself to be an authority figure by ignoring them when they first walked in, which, you know, bound to tick the Doctor off.
Is that a deliberate move on his part, though?
Oh, yeah, that's okay. A deliberate move. It's like, this is, I'm the boss, just making sure everyone knows I'm the boss.
So is he a lot smarter than he seems, Trenchard?
I don't think he's particularly smart. I think he just knows how to present the appearance of authority, but I don't think he's a particularly... smart character.
I think that might be the same staircase that's in the Doctor's lab, you know, that spiral staircase there.
I think it's the same staircase that crops up in God knows how many places in various different television shows.
Look at Pertwee's parcel. It's a fabulous publicity picture. But I do think, what's the actor's name who plays Trenchard?
Oh, I can't remember.
We'll look it up in between.
Yeah, we'll look it up in between.
Toby Haydock spinning in his... He's
sorry, Toby. I've not long listened to your commentary about the Sea Devils either, so never mind. If he's listening, I'm sure he'll forgive us.
I do think he manages to bring some dignity to the part, even though the writing obviously is sort of talking down to the character.
Very much so, yeah. He's the CSO Venetian blinds, yeah. Which is the how do we get a monitor? We don't actually want to put a television screen in. Let's put a bright yellow Venetian blind in and CSO the image.
But look at this. We go straight through the television.
That's a nice
through
cut.
The blinds into the room. That's, I think, Michael Bryan, hot off the heels of Colony in Space, where he learned a lot. And I know, in fact, I am going to pitch to you to do Colony in Space, because I think, one, you said you're willing to do it, and two, I think it would be a really interesting conversation, because I rather like it.
I'm very happy to do Colony in Space. I rather like Colony in Space.
But this is a more polished production.
Yes.
He's figured out kind of what works and what doesn't.
This is, as you say, this is a really nicely polished production.
I don't know how to start talking about Roger Delgado.
Oh.
Without fawning.
I mean, he's brilliant. There's not much else you can say. He's just absolutely superb.
Let me ask you a sort of potentially controversial question. Was he ever bettered? Okay, I don't think he was.
No, I don't think he was bettered. I think that the masters that followed did very well. I think Anthony Ainley wisely didn't try to emulate Roger Delgado and did his own thing, partly on the direction of John Nathan Turner to be a bit more arch and pantomime-esque. But
he brings value, though, doesn't
he?
You just saw the Five Doctors at the BFI.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely
shots
brilliant.
On a plane for you. Yeah.
And maybe seated.
You know the bit where, sorry, nothing to do with the scene, it was the bit where they go, it's a power-boosted open-ended transmod beam. And he goes, ooh. It's great.
I do like this scene with the Doctor and the Master where they have a bit of a laugh at Trenchard's expense.
The Doctor's concerned for him. He says, are they treating you all right?
Yeah.
You know. And do you know what? I think it was a very savvy move as well, because we've had a story set in a prison in the previous season, that they set it in this castle. It's a bit more visually interesting than just doing another prison set.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And the Doctor pleaded for him not to be executed, which is quite a...
I like it when Pertwee is suddenly incredibly intensely serious like that. He goes, you should consider yourself lucky. A lot of people were vying for the death penalty.
Yeah, I like the relationship between the Third Doctor and the Master.
I want to take it you're a changed man, Jason.
No, I'm the same as I ever was.
But the whole thing about the Master pretending to be a prisoner in this prison that he's completely in control of. Now, I don't know if you ever watched Bugs in the 90s.
Oh, yes, I did.
They had
the
character Jean Daniel in series 2, where in a lot of Stephen Gallagher episodes, and he was in prison. He was put away at the end of series 1. Right. And throughout series 2, he's doing all sorts of things from his prison cell. And then it turns out, two-thirds of the way through, he's brought out the prison. And he's now the governor. And he pulls a gun on the governor and shoots him. And I swear to God, Stephen Gallagher's watched this, because he's definitely a fan of Doctor Who. Yeah. I mean, it's ripe for sort of comedy, isn't it? It's so charming. It doesn't
quite handshaking part. Yeah, no, that was good.
It doesn't happen too often, does it? It makes that moment in Legopolis stand out, doesn't it?
It does. It does very much.
He's having a great time.
You feel sorry for him. Well, we were at school together. Yeah.
Do you think it's good that that's remained ambiguous?
Yes.
I'm surprised the new series, because they're usually so specific with sort of emotional relationships and things like that. But they haven't confirmed or denied anything, have they? Friends, relatives, it's all sort of been left up in the air.
It has, and I think it's better for it. I think that you can go a bit mad with connections and everything else like that.
Where do you think that line was going to end then, in Planet of Fire?
I think it did end. I don't think it was going to be your own something. I think it was show mercy to your own, as in one of your own people.
Yeah.
So I don't think it actually was going anyway.
Oh, I forgot to say, didn't I? Sorry, now the car's back on the screen. Yeah, Michael Bryant was like, well, I didn't want these boring cars in my thing. He goes, so I thought if I just take off the boot and all the doors, they'd look like futuristic space cars. And yeah. Barry Letts goes, yeah, but we're not in the future.
I love Barry Letts. He talks a lot of sense.
Oh, dear. But then, obviously, Michael Bryant is always going for the visual.
Yes.
How do you find this relationship, then, the Master and Trenchard?
I think it's great. I like the fact that they did something different with it, because by this point, we've had enough of the Master hypnotising people to do his bidding. He's done it in so many other places. So to actually have him just play on Trenchard's patriotism, as we later find out, it kind of makes the Master a more interesting character, that he's got the measure of the man and knows how to manipulate him, rather than just going straight for the hypnotic you will obey me kind of thing. He doesn't have that hold over Trenchard.
It's far less interesting in the Time Monster with, I forget the fella's name, you know, the guy who's...
Oh, Dr. Percival.
Yeah. Who... Like he does hypnotise him, doesn't he?
He does.
And he's just his stooge, yeah. Effectively.
Yeah. No, I think it's much better. Much better done this way. And it, as I say, it makes the Master more interesting because he can manipulate people. It's not just about his ability to hypnotise and control people. He can actually manipulate people in the way that a lot of other people do.
Psychologically. Well, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we?
Yeah. Is Royston Tickner as Robbins.
Is that his name?
Yeah, Royston Tickner. He was a friend of Michael E. Bryant's, also a sailing man. Michael E. Bryant is also... Have you seen the extra feature on the disc where he goes sailing?
No.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's good fun, Michael E. Bryant's thing.
They love spending money on these travelogues, don't they?
He does. But yeah, this is Royston Tickner, who was... But he'd been in Doctor Who before. He was Steinberger P. Green in The Dalek's Master Plan, The Feast of Stephen, the American director in the
movie. I mean, I don't know why I didn't spot him straight away, you know?
How did you not recognise him from that missing episode?
Not one of those Americans, was he? Oh, my God. Yeah.
What a great trick. Oh, yeah, that was him.
We had great fun with that, didn't we?
We did. So here's John Pertwee on the water, where he loves to be.
Not for the last time in this story.
No.
Oh, it's a nice calm day. Yeah, you couldn't see that in any great detail, all those boats in the old VHS version.
No, it was very, very grainy.
I feel like they've made the colours pop as well more. It just looks more...
The restoration work in these Blu-rays has been brilliant. So this building is now derelict.
Is that Portsmouth? Is it in
Portsmouth?
Yeah,
it's in Portsmouth. And it was a naval... supply station, I believe, but it's now a derelict building.
I think that's a really nice backcloth out that window there, because it's got depth to it, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. I didn't realise it was a backcloth until obviously I became more familiar with how they shoot television shows and things like that. But yeah, so here we are in Portsmouth on the beach. and there's June Murphy playing Blythe, who'd also been in Doctor Who before. She was Maggie Harris in Fury from the Deep.
What? I didn't know that.
Have you not been paying attention to my Twitter threads about Doctor Who actors who have been in things before?
I read all your Twitter threads. Yeah.
Well, you missed one.
I followed your cliffhanger thread with intense interest.
I'm still working on that one. I've moved into the new
series.
How did
I not know that was Maggie Harris?
I've no idea, Joe. How did you not know?
Every now and again, you know, because obviously I make some connections myself. Actors that have been in different things, the obvious ones, Michael Sheen, things like that, and even some of the more tenuous ones. I never realised that. Okay, I've learned something. Well, that's nice.
There you go.
Look how charming it is. I wonder if I can see your commanding officer.
I think most of those guys are actual naval people as well, because obviously they've had a lot of the naval people actually taking part in this.
Oh, this location. This all looks so expensive.
It does. It looks good.
It sort of feels... a bit Avengers-y. You know how that was always done on film and with lots of location work and lots of hardware? Yeah. Look at Joe on the motorbike.
Look, Joe on the motorcycle.
We've got to talk about Joe in this story.
The clangers! The clangers! Oh, didn't this get such a laugh and a cheer at the BFI?
Yeah.
What a brilliantly silly moment it is, and yet it kind of encapsulates the relationship between the Master and Trenchard.
Yeah.
His face.
The look where it only puppets, you know, for children.
Oh, and then the face is like, God, what an idiot.
It's so funny. Idiot. So, so funny. Oh, Delgado is sublime, isn't he? Terrence Dick says on the commentary, he goes, you know, every time Roger appears on the screen, the quality goes from there to there. Yeah, and he's right, isn't he? Like, he literally, he can lift anything.
He can.
I don't really think he's in a dud, you know, because I really like the Time Monster.
No, I think he's... I enjoy the Time Monster. I can see why people think it's a bit duff. And it certainly isn't devoid of flaws, but I enjoy the Time Monster.
Is this the story where he gets the line, I'm going to need a new television? Colour, of course.
Yeah.
But I think Hulk knows that he's a great character to write for as well, so he gives him... like top quality material.
Yeah, he's got some really good stuff in this.
Fuck me, when he's writing for him in Frontier in Space, some of those lines.
Yeah. No one else would be on a course for Earth. We are on a course for Earth. Well, naturally, because we're following them. Oh.
You're right, I made the Daleks stupid tin boxes. All we lacked in that story was that final scene that's in the book where he tidies up his papers.
There's that sea fort which I saw from the seafront, because I used to go to Portsmouth with my Nana McGramp, and we used to do the typically British thing. I don't know if people still do it, they probably don't. We used to drive somewhere with a thermos and a box of sandwiches.
Oh, when I was young, sit yes,
in the car, drinking your tea and eating your sandwiches, looking out of the windscreen. And I remember Victoria Wood lampooned that. And she says, why do we do that? Can you imagine going to the Taj Mahal and going, that's very nice, it would look better with a windscreen wiper and a tax disc?
We went to Chelsea, right, and we rented a caravan, and we never left the caravan. We sat in the caravan the whole week. Like, I'm like, now looking back, back in the day, I was like, this is amazing, yeah, we're going somewhere new. But yeah, what were we thinking?
But that was a thing. We used to go, we used to watch the boats going in. When I was a kid, my Dad used to drive us down to New Haven Harbour, and we'd watch the boats going because of the New Haven Dieppe ferry, and we'd watch them going. And I was very familiar with the ferries. I used to recognise the different funnels. I still remember all their names.
I worked just by the harbour, because there's a store just there, for a couple of weeks. And I used to go down on my lunch break, watch the boats coming in and out. It's still a joy, you know.
Yeah.
God, there's so much I want to talk about in this. I've just heard Malcolm Clarke's music, but maybe I'll save that for episode two.
Save the music for episode two.
I do want to say about that C4, he shoots that brilliantly. Mm. But and it's that sort of fallacy that Doctor Who's always overlit. The light comes right down. In fact, it looks like it's on location half the time.
Yeah, the studios in this are really good. As we said, it's a really polished location. The location and the studios match up. Sometimes in Doctor Who, you'll get a studio which is supposed to be inside something that they've shot on location. You think, but that doesn't... Where does that get... I can't work out how that fits. Whereas this all looks very much... You know, this interior of Captain Hart's office is exactly how you'd imagine the inside of that building that we just saw to look. And I imagine it's exactly how it did look.
And, you know, I always think directors are magicians, because earlier on you had a sequence where we were looking out the window, we went on location to see the Doctor coming in, then he shot from outside looking in the window, so it all gave a very sort of inside-outside perspective. You know... And that sounds like an obvious thing to do, but Doctor Who directors aren't always that thoughtful.
No. But this set on the fort, the guys doing their thing, I mean, it's so well lit and dressed and everything. I can almost smell the old the old brickwork and iron.
The rust.
And the salt air and everything. I can almost imagine being...
There's exactly lots of little sort of set dressing as well. The tins on there, rusty old radio. Yeah, this shot looking down
from the ladder. Yeah, that's
unusual. A mirror shot, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's unusual.
And we do it a couple of times in the first two episodes because he's got a really imaginative shot, so he wants to keep doing it. There's the echo on their voices, there's the echo on the floor.
Yeah.
As well, so it doesn't sound like a load of sort of plywood.
And the brickwork looks really good. You know, it's not brickwork, it's fake brickwork because this is in a studio, but it, you know.
Barry Letts is hugely complimentary of the lighting in this story.
The
way it's been
put together, it's, as you say, it's a very polished production. This, of course, is Declan Mulholland in his
master.
Jabba the Hutt, before they decided that Jabba the Hutt was going to be a big slug because they cut him out of the original.
It didn't
Star
stop
Wars.
Him going to all those conventions, though, did it?
Well, of course not.
That's, look at that shot there, the Sea Devil's head turning around in the dark.
Yeah.
They knew how to do it back then, you know, enticing little glimpses of the monsters. The Pertwee sitting on the sofa there looked like he owns the place. Oh, dear. Okay, can we just address his arrogance? Is it funny or is it irritating? Because I've heard both arguments and I know we're awful.
I think it straddles that line very effectively. And I think it makes a nice edge to the character. He's not just a nice bloke coming in trying to help.
No.
It works because Pertwee really gives the Doctor the air of underlying frustration that he's stuck on this planet. You know, he hasn't just arrived and got himself involved. He's stuck on Earth. He doesn't want to be on Earth. But he's kind of got to get on with it. So I think it adds a nice little bit of edge to it. Of course, he's mad as a hatter because he's just mentioned being friends with Horatio Nelson.
He was a close personal friend of mine. You know, I mean, the way he does it with such gravity. Oh, look, the fella's as mad as a hatter.
Yeah. Oh, Edwin Richfield as Captain Hart is superb. And God, was he wasted in The Twin Dilemma.
Yeah, I talked about that very recently, actually. Yeah.
Why that would you mask. Take an actor of that calibre and whack him under
tons of
rubber?
It's the voice, I think, isn't it? It's the voice. And it's a good voice.
And with arms that don't move.
Take care not to blow their hearts or minds.
Now, is that Katie Manning climbing that ladder, do we think?
Stuart Fell wiggling his bottom.
Stuart Fell, yeah.
It's a split-level set as well. Like, I know we're sort of focusing on the production value of this thing, but that's because you can't always do that with classic Doctor Who's.
No, not always. There's a lot of work that's gone into these sets to make them look authentic.
Yeah.
I mean, you could believe that they're on an old sea fort with the dim light. The light hanging from the ceiling, that's one of the things I like. You don't get that an awful lot.
Look, the hand, we've seen the head, we've seen the hand coming out over the boat now.
And all the bits hanging up.
A lot of people said, like, you know, that was sort of the Douglas Canfield specialty of showing parts of the monster. But, well, I suppose they were doing it right back as far as the Daleks, though, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, it's a classic. I mean, it's, you know, Doctor Who didn't exactly pioneer the technique of hiding the monster until a certain point.
But what's really nice about this as well is just how sort of measured the pace is.
Mm.
It's not going too fast, but there's enough going on to keep you interested.
Yeah. Some of the longer stories in particular suffer from momentum issues. Either episode one will be incredibly dull because it doesn't want to get too far, or episode one will race along and then the plot will have to slow right down to extend it through six episodes. I think this actually holds up six episodes really nicely.
There's only one point in this where I feel like they're vying for time.
There he is again.
And that's quite well lit, so you can see the mask. But it's a good mask.
It is a good
sorry,
mask.
Uncle Brian. It's a good mask.
And yeah, sorry, the monster where the eyes don't move. There are plenty of things. There are plenty of things in the sea with eyes that do not move.
Oh, that's very true. Yeah.
So there's no reason why the Sea Devil shouldn't have static eyes.
Based on a turtle head, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
That's quite grim, isn't it? The camera is literally fixed on his dead face as they come towards him.
Yeah. I don't envy him that having to be dead with his eyes open thing, though. I've done that on stage a couple of times. It's not easy to be dead on stage, for one thing, because, of course, everyone goes, oh, you're still breathing. Of course I'm still breathing. I'm not actually dead. But I had to die in a school production of Macbeth.
Right.
And the way the script had been written was I would die on stage. And then at the end of the battle, another character would come in and mourn my death and close my eyes. That was explicitly written into the thing. So I had to lie there on the stage with my eyes wide open in death.
How long for?
Not for too long, but I could see into the wings where all my wonderfully supportive friends who were in the play with me were going, oi, wanker! And sticking their fingers
they
up.
They were trying to make your corpse.
Exactly, they were trying to make me corpse while I was being a corpse.
Did you corpse as a corpse?
I did not.
Oh, well done.
I did not. I was
professional to the last.
I did give them a piece of my mind afterwards.
Now, that cliffhanger there was a cheat.
That cliffhanger there, I never really worked for me.
What did you give that out of 10 in your threads? Do you recall?
I can't remember, and it's too far back for me to go.
Well, let's rate them
now.
As we go now, shall we?
But I rated that one fairly low, because I think it's fairly obvious that it's Declan Mulholland shuffling through. Even though they put him in the shadow, it's clearly not the monster that we saw earlier.
No.
So I think it's pretty obvious that it's just the other chap shuffling around.
It's a shame, because I feel like the suspense has built well in those last sort of 5 minutes. So it could have just been the Sea Devil.
It could have been, yeah. But I think it's kind of, well, we need a cliffhanger, so let's just put this in and have them a bit uncertain about this shuffling character for a bit.
But what I think this episode has done extremely well is it has built up a mystery. It's gone to the base and given us some details of how many ships this has affected. So we've had some context. We've then gone to one of these locations where the Sea Devils are attacking, so it's all actually happening. Thrown the Doctor in the situation. He's now in a situation of peril. I think that's a good episode one. Suspense, mystery, a little bit of drama, and some comedy as well.
And we know the Master's involved already.
Yeah, oh, and some charming scenes for the Master as well. Yeah. Actually, it's a great episode one.
I think it's a really good episode one, yeah. It is.
Do you think we should go and watch episode two?
I think we should watch episode two.
It's so lovely doing this live with you, you know.
It's marvellous. Great fun.
I'll go and put the kettle on, quick.
What a good idea.